Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the main stories in science. Our lead story today concerns strange markings on the planet Mars. If you've been on the internet recently, you know that Google Mars is now available, complements of satellites that orbit the red planet. Just like Google Earth, you can actually Google different landmarks on the red planet. And sure enough, conspiracy theorists have found new markings on the surface of Mars. This one that looks just like Gandhi, believe it or not. You see the ears, the eyes, the nose, the collar, the hair. It's remarkable. And the question is, what is this face on Mars that looks like Gandhi? And for that matter, there's strange markings on the planet Earth in the Gobi Desert. Conspiracy theorists are going wild because there's crisscrossing patterns in the middle of the desert. Was it left by ancient aliens from outer space? Well, we'll discuss all the different theories on exploration. And then we'll say a few things about the recent Nobel Prize in Physics. Once in a generation, there is an astronomical or physics observation that gives you a paradigm shift. It forces us to throw out the old picture of the universe and adopt totally new paradigms to explain the universe. The Nobel Prize in Physics was given to three astronomers who show that the universe is not slowing down, as previously thought in an expanding universe, but actually accelerating, speeding up, careening out of control. In fact, this gives rise to the theory that the universe may die in a big freeze much sooner than we originally expected. And theories to try to account for this fact have floundered. In fact, the mismatch between theory and practice is about 10 to the 120. That's 1 with 120 zeros after it. That is the largest mismatch between theory and experiment in the history of science. There's a whole shelf full of Nobel Prizes waiting for someone who can explain this tremendous mismatch between theory and practice. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. He's a Nobel Prize winner. We're very glad to have with us MIT physicist Frank Wilczek. He got the Nobel Prize in Physics for his research on what is called quantum chromodynamics, the theory of the strong interactions. And today we'll be talking about his book, The Lightness of Being. We'll be talking about the Large Hadron Collider, the search for a unified field theory, and the search for a theory of everything on exploration. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. If you've been on the internet, you know there's something called Google Earth, where you can zero in on your house or anyone else's house from outer space. The results from our satellites is computerized and put on the internet, and you can actually Google your own house and see your house or your relatives from outer space. Now Google Mars is available. That's right, believe it or not, we have orbiting satellites that have pretty much photographed every square foot of the surface of Mars, and it's all computerized, and it's on the internet now. And of course, conspiracy theorists love it, and they've zeroed in on something called Gandhi, the face of Gandhi on Mars. Well, I've looked at it, and by golly, it really does look like Gandhi. You see the ears, you see the head, you see the eyes, the noses, the chin, the collar. I mean, oh my God. I mean, do the Martians like Gandhi for some strange reason? Well, of course, when you get finer details, you see that much of the faces of Mars that we see in these photographs simply dissolve. Now, in higher resolution, these pictures are also available, you find that the face on Mars is not really a mountaintop at all. it looks like you're looking at a mountain. Actually, you're looking at a depression. It's an optical illusion. And under finer resolution, you see that it's actually a crater. It's actually not a face at all, like a mound. It's actually a depression on the surface of Mars. And all the features, the ears, the nose, so on and so forth, simply dissolve when you take a good look. And the reason why the human brain so easily sees faces on Mars and faces in the clouds is because, well, it's good for evolution. Independent of your wishes, without your control, when you look at the sky and you see clouds, you see faces and familiar objects in the sky. And the reason is very simple. Long time ago, our ancestors had to live in the forest in the presence of predators. And 9 times out of 10, if there was rustling in the forest and you thought you saw a tiger in the forest, 9 times out of 10, it was harmless and nothing happened. However, maybe 1 time out of 10, there really was a tiger out there. So in other words, this early warning system is good for our evolution. Our ancestors were timid monkeys. That is, they feared the fact that any rustling in the forest, any form that resembled a tiger, could in fact be a tiger. So most of the time, it was basically nothing. However, once in a while, it saved our butt. And that's why we are descended from these ape-like creatures who were basically timid. And speaking about conspiracy theorists on the internet, you've probably also seen those strange markings in the Gobi Desert. It's some kind of square, looks like a landing field of some sort, but inside it's like a jigsaw puzzle with all sorts of different kinds of lines. Now, it's obviously not a natural formation. Natural formations don't create squares, and all of a sudden inside squares, all this crisscross pattern. So what is it? Well, on the internet, you see all sorts of different kinds of speculations as to what this is. However, a NASA scientist has said, no, it's not Martians. It's not outer space people trying to make airstrips on the planet Earth. It's nothing but markings used by the Chinese military to calibrate their spy satellites. In fact, the United States does that too. In order to calibrate our spy satellites, sometimes even in the U.S., the military creates markings on the surface of the planet, and then we ask the satellite to zero in on these markings and calibrate their location. So GPS, of course, is great, but it's also good to calibrate our satellites using surface markings, and that's all it is, apparently. So these bizarre surface markings in the Gobi Desert are not signs of ancient visitations by aliens or alien airfields. They're simply markings used by the Chinese military to calibrate their spy satellites. Well, also, the Nobel Prize in Physics, awarded a few months ago, is continuing to send shockwaves throughout the scientific community because it basically recognizes a glaring deficiency in our understanding of the universe. The universe, we once thought, is gradually slowing down. There's the Big Bang, universe expanded, and we think gravity over time overtakes the expansion of the Big Bang, and it slows down. Boy, were we wrong. We now realize that instead of slowing down, the universe is speeding up. It's accelerating. It's careening out of control. And as it expands enormously, it could create a big freeze. We could all freeze to death billions of years into the future, much sooner than we thought, because the universe is expanding so rapidly. And why? Well, this is quite embarrassing. We don't know why. We think there's something called dark energy. Dark energy was predicted by Einstein. Dark energy is the energy of the vacuum. Believe it or not, even nothing has energy. And that energy is repulsive. And that energy acts like anti-gravity, pushing the galaxies apart. In fact, that's why we think there was a bang to begin with. The original bang of the Big Bang was caused by this dark energy which pushed the galaxies apart, creating the expanding universe. Then, for some reason, dark energy disappeared. But now is coming back with a vengeance. And 3 astronomers showed that the universe is not slowing down at all. It's actually accelerating. Now, here's the rub. We have no theory to explain this. The very fate of the universe itself hinges on our understanding of dark energy, and we are clueless as to what dark energy is. The latest results are, get this, 73% of the matter energy content of the universe is in the vacuum, dark energy, the energy of nothing. Then 23% is in the form of dark matter, invisible matter, matter we cannot see, matter that surrounds the galaxies. And then 4% of the universe is basically stars, hydrogen and helium. And where are we? Believe it or not, we are 0.03% of the universe. We are the oddball. We are the freaks. We are the exception. Most of the universe is dark in the form of dark energy and dark matter. Now, you may say to yourself, okay, so what is it? Give us the answer. The answer is, we don't know. We don't know what dark matter is. We don't know what dark energy is. Now, the leading theory that may explain everything is something called string theory. I work in string theory. This is what I do for a living. This is my day job. In fact, I'm the co-founder of string field theory. Now, it turns out that string theory does give you an explanation for these things. Dark matter, for example, invisible matter, would represent the next octave of the string. We represent the lowest octave of the string, neutrons, protons, quarks. We represent the lowest octave of a string, but there are higher octaves, higher musical notes. And that's what we think dark matter is. But what is dark energy? Well, string theory can explain dark energy too. However, to calculate the amount of dark energy, you have to put that number in by hand. And that's what we don't like. We physicists don't like to put numbers in by hand because it represents a deficiency in our theory. But hey, even string theory has this problem. Now, the mismatch between theory and experiment is 10 to the 120. That is 1 with 120 zeros after it. That is the largest mismatch in the history of the universe. Think about it. Theory and practice are sometimes off. Well, usually we're off by a factor of 2, 5, maybe a factor of 10. This time we're off by a factor of over a Google, 1 with 120 zeros after it. That is a huge mismatch, which simply means that there's a shelf full of Nobel Prizes waiting for the young physicists who can figure out why we are so wrong. Well, one machine which may give us some of the answers is the Large Hadron Collider. And in a few more moments, we'll be bringing on a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Frank Wilczek of MIT, author of a new book called The Lightness of Being. And he'll talk about the Large Hadron Collider. First of all, the Large Hadron Collider is an atom smasher. It is 17 miles in circumference, making it the largest machine of science ever built in the history of humankind. It slams two beams of protons together at titanic energies, 14 trillion electron volts, energy not seen since the instant of the Big Bang itself. Now, is it dangerous? And the answer is no, because no matter how powerful and awesome this machine is, it's basically a pea shooter compared to the enormous energies that Mother Nature can muster in outer space. I mean, give me a break. Mother Nature can slam two black holes together, creating enormous quantities of energy, much greater than anything we can create with the Large Hadron Collider. So is it dangerous? No. Is it going to eat up the Earth? No. Is it going to create a black hole? No. But there are some people who think so. Conspiracy theorists on the web, once again. But the Large Hadron Collider may reveal the nature of dark matter. Dark matter, as we said before, is invisible. If you held it in your hand, it would be invisible, but it would seep right through your fingers. Because it has no electric charge, like neutrons, it would actually penetrate right through your hand and go to the center of the Earth, and then keep on going to China. And in fact, it would then oscillate between China and New York, as if the Earth weren't really there. That's how mysterious dark energy and dark matter are. And the Large Hadron Collider may give us a clue. Now, the immediate goal of the Large Hadron Collider is to find the Higgs boson. In other words, we have a jigsaw puzzle of subatomic particles. They all seem to fit into what is called the standard model, but there's one glaring piece missing. The missing piece is the Higgs boson, and we expect to find it. No mystery there. However, we want to go beyond the standard model of particles. We want to find what the next octaves of the string may be, and we think it's dark matter. Dark matter, by the way, holds the galaxy together. You may say to yourself, well, what's in it for me? Well, it turns out that dark matter holds the galaxy together. If it wasn't for dark matter, the Earth would be plunged into deep space. The Earth would have frozen over perhaps billions of years ago, and we would not be here to talk about it on radio. And so in other words, in some sense, we owe everything to dark matter, something that is invisible, but basically holds the galaxy together. So in other words, for those people who think that we know everything about the universe, we have been in for a shock. In the last 10, 15 years, all textbooks, all physics textbooks had to be rewritten because we know-it-all physicists found out that we didn't know it all. There's been a paradigm shift in our understanding of the universe. So, for all you young, enterprising scientists out there, if you want to win a Nobel Prize, all you have to do is explain dark matter and dark energy, and we will give you a Nobel Prize in physics. I'd like to introduce our very special guest for today. I'm very delighted to introduce a colleague of mine, Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek of MIT, talking about his latest book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces, which comes out this month. So once again, today we are going to be talking about the Large Hadron Collider. How dangerous is it? What do we hope to get from the Large Hadron Collider? Is there a unified field theory, the theory that eluded Einstein in the last 30 years of his life? So we're going to take a journey to the far reaches of science, cosmology, and physics with Professor Frank Wilczek, winner of the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics. The first question for you, Professor Wilczek, is how did you as a youth first get interested in science?
I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in quantity and taking things apart and putting them together. My earliest memories are taking a coffee percolator that we had in the house, taking it apart and putting it together many, many times and sort of puzzling over how it might make sense and work, and playing with large numbers. And then when I was 5 or 6 years old, I saved up for many months my poultry allowance to get a month. Telescope.
When you were 5 years old, you were already interested in telescopes.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty early.
Interested in very big things and very big numbers.
Uh-huh.
Spent a lot of time also changing money from one form into another, you know, nickels into dimes, into quarters, and back and forth. I was hoping that I could come out ahead. A few times I did, but then I had to check. It persists, unfortunately.
I see.
I think, you know, people on Wall Street are still trying and learning that it doesn't work.
Without much luck.
Anyway, I was growing up, I was very young at the time of Sputnik also, and the whole country was energized, I think, by the idea of having a scary enemy, also of space being a frontier. So I grew up in that atmosphere. I had very good teachers New York Public School. So it was a very natural thing for me to go into science. I never really thought about doing anything else.
Okay, so there was a telescope. Was there anything else? A chemistry kit, a visit to the planetarium?
Oh, I had chemistry kits. I had, well, I did all those things.
Uh-huh.
But they were sort of pushing me in the direction I was already going.
I see. Okay. And then why physics? I mean, some people go
into... Well, physics was an accident, really. I, in kind of a last-minute thing, I, as I said, I was very interested. I was always enchanted with mathematics and patterns. But when I studied all kinds of things, very curious. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Exactly. When I went to the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, I originally intended to figure out how minds work. But that was a worthy problem.
We still don't know.
About a few hours in the laboratory, in the neurophysiology laboratory, really cured me of that. It was clear that it was a slow business and didn't use very much mathematics at the time. So I put off the decision. I majored in mathematics with the idea that I wouldn't do pure mathematics, but I'd somehow use mathematics. I went to Princeton as a graduate student in mathematics, in fact. But fortunately for me, the mathematics building and the physics building in Princeton are contiguous.
So it was
very
accident,
easy
huh?
to wander over to the physics department. And at that time, in the early 70s, as you know, the physics was very, very exciting. And great ideas were in the air that used the kind of mathematics that I knew about and really liked, mathematics of symmetry and the mathematics of analysis. And so I jumped in with both feet, and I found out I was really good at it and never looked back.
Okay, well, let's talk about those times. Most people understand that things are made out of atoms, and that inside the atom there's a tiny core called the nucleus.
Yeah.
And we hear buzzwords like inside the nucleus there are neutrons and protons.
Yeah.
But in the 1960s and 70s, a new concept was introduced called the quark. Could you explain to us what is a quark in relationship to these neutrons and protons and atoms?
Right. So you described it accurately down to the level of neutrons and protons. And then you can make a crude model of atomic nuclei, the central parts of atoms that contain all of their positive charge and almost all their mass in a really tiny core. You can make a crude model of that by saying that they're made out of particles called protons and neutrons. And then people originally thought that the next chapter in physics that would sort of finalize the theory of matter would be to figure out equations that describe the forces between protons and neutrons that held nuclei together. But when people start to study the forces between protons and neutrons, they found the equations getting more and more complicated. They didn't look elegant like Newton's laws of gravity or the Maxwell equation, Coulomb's law of electrodynamics. They were a real mess, depending on velocity, spin, and energy in extremely complicated ways. So people got the idea that protons and neutrons weren't simple objects, that they really were complicated objects, maybe made out of simpler things. And by a long series of investigations, theoretical and experimental, an epic struggle that deserves its Homer or Milton, but we'll just skip to the chase, which is that we discovered that inside protons and neutrons are particles that do obey simple equations. These are called quarks and gluons. And they obey beautiful equations worthy of standing beside Newton's and Einstein's and Maxwell's equations.
Now, earlier,
we can solve those equations to show that protons and neutrons are built out of the quark and gluon.
Now, previously on Exploration, we had Steven Weinberg, also a Nobel Prize winner, and he said that in the 1960s, it was so frustrating trying to understand protons and neutrons that he wrote that perhaps they are beyond the realm of the human mind, that
yes.
perhaps nature was so...
There was a tremendous, yeah? There was a tremendous feeling of frustration and impotence building up for many years in the study of protons and neutrons. It just seemed to be a mess, and people couldn't get a handle on it. I didn't know that Weinberg said things like that, but I know famously Freeman Dyson around 1970 said that it would be 100 years before people understood the strong interaction, that is, protons and neutrons.
Well,
but then, you never can tell how difficult a problem is until it's solved. And a couple of years later, we solved it. We basically figured out, we said, you know, if you have the right clues and insist on following them to the end, sometimes you get lucky. And in this case, we found that by following out the logical implications of one particular striking fact about sparks, namely that when they get close together, their interaction gets weaker. This is called asymptotic freedom. By following out the logical implications of that, we were led to absolutely unique equations that also led to other predictions that turned out to be true, and so that's now the accepted theory.
So with this new theory of quarks called quantum chromodynamics, and with your contribution, that is asymptotic freedom, for which you won the Nobel Prize in Physics, do we now have a relatively good grasp of the phenomenon called quarks at very, very high energies?
Yeah, we can. The equations for the behavior of quarks remarkably become simpler, as opposed to more complicated at high energy. So we understand how protons and neutrons interact when they're bashed together at extremely high energies, especially how the quarks inside them interact, the gluons, at extremely high energies, much better than we understand how they interact at low energies, where the equations are harder to solve. And you need giant computers to do it. So that's very, very useful in enabling us to design and interpret experiments at high energies to explore new physics of production of heavy particles, sort of thing that would be done at the LHC. It also comes in very handy when we want to study the early universe because in very near the Big Bang, the typical energies were very, very high. And so the fact that the equations simplify and we can deal with them is extremely handy and really has opened up the early universe to scientific exploration.
Okay, now we have something called the Standard Model. That is, we have so much trust in this theory of quarks, this theory of electrons and neutrinos. We have something called the Standard Model. However, there's one missing piece of the Standard Model called the Higgs boson. So tell us a little bit about how accurate this Standard Model is. How elegant is it, and what is this Higgs boson that people are talking about?
Okay, well, that's quite an agenda, but let's go through it. How accurate is the Standard Model, first of all? Well, one of the striking things about it is that you can calculate some things to extraordinarily high precision, and I don't mean calculate something that's equal to 1 or something that's equal to 2, something that's a very non-trivial number with many, many meaningful digits work very well.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today is Professor Frank Wilczek, winner of the 2004 Nobel Prize, author of a new book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And also, why don't you pick up a copy of my latest book? My latest book is called Physics of the Impossible, a scientific exploration into the world of phasers, force fields, teleportation, and time travel. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with a colleague of mine, Professor Frank Wilczek, winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004, author of a delightful new book called The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces. And so today, we're going to talk about a dream of Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein dreamed that one day, perhaps we'll be able to write down an equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, which would summarize all the forces of the universe. The gravitational force, which anchors us on the Earth and holds the Sun and the Earth together. The electromagnetic force, which lights up our cities and terrifies us with thunder, but gives us computer, lasers, and the information revolution. And then we have the weak and the strong nuclear force, which light up the universe, light up the stars, light up the heavens. He wanted a single theory, a single equation which could explain all of that. The whole shebang. Just like the one-inch equation, E equals mc squared, can unify mass with energy, he wanted a similar equation which could unify everything into one comprehensive field. Well, he didn't get it. However, today we have the Large Hadron Collider, which we think can begin to probe some of the mysteries of this theory if it exists. We even have a candidate for it, string theory. However, not everyone agrees that it is a theory of everything because it's so difficult to test. So once again, we have with us Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek, and we're going to be discussing his latest book, The Lightness of Being, and also The Large Hadron Collider. Professor Wilczek, where we last left off, we were talking about the standard model of subatomic particles and how accurate it is. Many parts of the model have been tested to one part in 10 billion. However, there is a missing ingredient in the standard model. Can you elaborate?
It's missing one little ingredient that has that appears in centrally conceptually, but hasn't yet been checked. And also it has some inelegance, which we'd like to deal with. So the missing ingredient is what's sometimes called the Higgs particle, or Higgs field. And the way I like to explain it is, imagine you had very intelligent fish, say super dolphins, who for millennia have been swimming around in an ocean. That's their environment. They take that for granted. They don't think of it as a thing. They think of it as just emptiness. That's what's always there. But then they get scientific, they get more sophisticated, and realize that they could get a nicer description of the world with simpler laws of motion if they postulate that they're embedded in a medium, namely water, that's slowing them down and affecting their motion. That's the situation we've found ourselves in. We're those fish. We've found that we can get a much nicer description of the world if we postulate that we're embedded in a medium that changes the motion of particles and slows them down. And this medium is usually called the Higgs field. And the thing that's exciting now is that we are going to test we're going to find out what this Higgs field is made out of. We don't have any very concrete idea of what it's made out of. You know, it's there and affects things, but we don't know what the atoms or molecules of it are. Certainly, it can't be made out of any material that we understand well and have seen in the past.
Okay.
It has to have new properties. The simplest possibility is that it's one new particle. That's called the Higgs particle. I think it's likely to be more interesting than that. But in any case, the LHC will have enough oomph, enough power, enough concentrated energy to find out.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the Large Hadron Collider a few times, and it's, of course, been in the news for the last month or so. So let's talk about the Large Hadron Collider. It's 17 miles in circumference.
Yes.
So why? Why did so many nations, over 12 nations, why did they contribute $8 billion to build the largest machine of science? So describe to us, what is the Large Hadron Collider, and what does it do?
Okay. Well, I like to say it's our civilization's answer to the pyramids. It's a gigantic effort that really expresses our commitment to our dedication to curiosity. I think it's better than the pyramids, actually, because it's a monument to curiosity as opposed to superstition. Its size is not vanity, but necessary to do the job that it's meant to do. Now, what it is physically is, as you said, a 17 or 18 mile circumference ring that straddles the border between Switzerland and France. The ring is underground, and it's filled with powerful superconducting magnets that operate at near absolute zero. So they have to be bathed in liquid helium. It's a fantastic engineering project. These magnets are like the magnets that do magnetic resonance imaging in hospitals, but more powerful and still 18 miles of tunnel with them, all cooled down to near zero. And what all this is for, mechanically, is to accelerate and store two beams of protons moving in opposite directions around the circle. The protons are enormously energetic. They've been accelerated to within a part in a million of the speed of light. And then at a few points, the beams are made to cross and collisions occur. And in these collisions, conditions last seen within a microsecond of the Big Bang are produced in a very, very small volume and for a very short time, but these very extreme conditions are reproduced. And that allows us to study the possibility of new processes that occur on very, very short scales of time and distance, very high scales of energy. And by surrounding the collisions with fantastic detectors that are crammed with state-of-the-art electronics to measure how many things are coming out and how fast and what they are, detectors are 10 stories on a side, like marvels of engineering themselves. Information they generate gets stored, gets processed in a new computer architecture to handle the gush of information. And all that gets interpreted. And then we'll see what space and time look like at resolutions that weren't before possible. So in a sense, another sense, what it is a gigantic microscope. I call it an ultra-stroboscopic nanomicroscope. But it's in the tradition of Leeuwenhoek looking with light and finding that organisms are made out of cells, or Rosalind Franklin using X-rays to get better resolution and finding that DNA molecules are made out have a definite molecular structure. But we're looking at to look at distances a billion times smaller than that, and at those distances the action is very fast, so you have to take a kind of flash picture. You need this very, very exotic kind of microscope. That's really what the LHC is.
Okay. Now, recently there was a lawsuit in the federal court in Hawaii calling for an injunction to stop the Large Hadron Collider, even though it's a European machine,
yes,
stating that it'll create a black hole, which will then eat up the Earth, and therefore we have to stop the machine in order to save humanity.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, will this machine create black holes? If so, are they dangerous?
It almost certainly won't produce black holes, but there are some logically possible, although rather gratuitous, I think, speculations that could suggest theoretical ideas that could enable the production of very, very tiny black holes at the LHC. However, an important thing to emphasize that is that these black holes, as physical objects, have really nothing in common with the image that people have of a black hole being a gigantic object that swallows things up, other than the name. These black holes that are, again, very speculative, if they could exist at all, these black holes, if they did exist and did get produced at the LHC, would be much smaller than a proton, would exert gravitational fields much smaller than the gravitational field of a speck of dust, and moreover, would not live very long. They're highly unstable. They're quantum mechanical objects. And the same project, the same processes that allow them to get produced also allow them to decay, run them backwards. So there's really no danger. If these black holes exist, as suggested only in very speculative theory, what it really would amount to is that in one of these collisions at CERN, instead of the particles escaping in 10 to the minus 24th second from the reaction zone, they might escape in a much longer time, like 10 to the minus 15th second, because the gravity would hold them back for a while. But really, there's absolutely no cause for concern.
Now, on a human scale, the Large Hadron Collider looks humongous, but on a scale of Mother Nature, doesn't Mother Nature create cosmic rays that are, in fact, more powerful than the energies attained by the Large Hadron Collider? And the Earth has been bathed by these cosmic rays for billions of years, and we're still here, right?
Yes, that's also true. That's the empirical answer to all reasonable questions about the safety of the LHC, which is that although it will bring these extreme conditions really into focus for us for the first time in a way that we can study systematically and control, Mother Nature has been doing this kind of experiment for a long time on a vast scale throughout the universe. There are cosmic rays, which are largely protons, but that have some of them, small fraction, but some of them do have energies that are comparable to the energies that would be achieved at the LHC. In fact, roughly once per century per football field at the top of the atmosphere, an event like that, a collision between a high-energy cosmic ray and the top of the atmosphere occurs. And so if anything catastrophic were going to happen, it would have already happened.
And also the energy of these mini black holes, because they're only produced, I think, at the maximum rate of one a second, and they don't have much of a lifetime. Isn't it true that you couldn't even light up a light bulb with the energy of these things?
Well, I haven't done that calculation, but it would certainly be a very inefficient way to try to run a light bulb, and probably it wouldn't work.
Right. Okay, well, now let's get right into the heart of your latest book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces. First of all, why did you choose this title, The Lightness of Being?
Well, there's a novel that I love very much called The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera, which was also made into a very good sexy movie. So it's a homage to that. But it's a very appropriate title, with the slight modification I gave, in two ways, and that's why I'm using it. First of all, one of the big themes of the book is that in the past, the difference between light and matter has been a big theme in literature and metaphors and just the way people think. So light is somehow thought of as celestial, whereas matter is advantage of modern physics is that light and matter are really not two different things. They're different aspects of one underlying thing that's common to all matter. And that thing, that modern understanding of what matter is much closer to the traditional idea of what light is than the traditional idea of what matter is. So I really like that idea, and that's why it's the lightness of being. The other thing is that another big theme is that the world is a much richer place than appears to the naked eye. Our eyes were not designed or evolved, I guess, to perceive all the structure in the world, knowing about deep structure of reality, which is largely set by the structure of processes going on all the time in empty space, the Higgs field we talked about before, the spontaneous activity of quantum fluctuations or virtual particles, quantum fields, the modern ether that can create or destroy particles. The matter we see is really excitations in this medium. The idea that by enhancing our senses and both with instruments and by thinking, we enlarge our concept of the world is a concept I love. And to me, it makes the world not only bearable, but really enchanted and enchanting. And so that's why I deleted unbearable from Kundera's title and just called it lightness.
Okay, now let's also talk about the ether. Some historians of science say that in 1905, Albert Einstein banished this concept of an ether, a substance which was supposed to pervade emptiness throughout the universe and allow for the transmission of light, absolute frame of reference, said Isaac Newton. So why use the word ether in your title?
Well, I used ether in the title because I thought people would be shocked by it and intrigued. And whereas if I used the modern word, which I'm introducing, grid, or something which is conceptually related to the ether, but of course correct and cleaned up and enhanced, people would just scratch their heads and not know what it is.
So
I mentioned the ether without endorsing the old concept of ether, which Einstein indeed modified. I wouldn't say he swept them away. In fact, Einstein himself talked approvingly of the ether, not in 1905, but by 1920 he had come around. In modern physics, it's very, very far from the case that what we perceive as empty space, that is, regions devoid of obvious particles or obvious matter, that's empty. In fact, in modern physics, the primary reality is stuff that's everywhere and every when. The stuff is, call it quantum fields, but it's more than that. They're spontaneous activity of fields that fill all space. They're also actual materials that pervade all space. Very, very reminiscent of the old ether is something called the sigma field, which fills all space. So it's made out of quarks and anti-quarks. We thought of quite literally as matter filling all space. And whereas the old ether wanted oscillations of a material filling all space to be photons, what we found is that there actually is a material that oscillates not to make photons, but to make what are called pi-mesons, particles that were discovered first in the 1950s. So there is a modern descendant of the ether that not only exists but dominates modern physics, and even has a density that we've weighed recently. I call it the grid because the ether has a bad reputation, and the grid is both different from and much more than the old ether.
Okay, and also in the title of your book, you mentioned the unification of forces. On exploration, we've had Brian Green of Columbia, Lisa Randall of Harvard, talking about string theory, membrane theory. But we've also had Freeman Dyson, a physicist at Princeton, on the radio waves. And he was famous for saying that, quote, the road to the unified field theory is littered with the corpses of failed attempts. So the question is, what are your thoughts? Do you think there really is this cosmic theory of everything, or is it really just an illusion, a mirage? What are your thoughts?
Well, there very well may be a theory of everything. I mean, we should keep striving to learn more and more, but I don't think we're really very close to dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's and getting a legitimate theory of everything. However, I think we're poised to make a big leap in understanding that goes beyond the standard model or core theory that's the basis of our thinking today. In the present core theory, we have four distinct interactions: gravity, electromagnetism, and the two new forces discovered in the 20th century, the strong and weak force. And we also have, very roughly speaking, four different kinds of matter: quarks, electrons, photons, and gluons. So four forces and four kinds of matter seems like too many. We'd like to get a more unified view of it all. And there are very concrete, very pretty, and suggestive ideas for how to bring these forces together that are explained in the book, that are not just dreams. And I think this is where it differs from previous attempts, like Einstein's attempt to make a unified field theory. That is, you can calculate some consequences of this proposed unification. And nature seems to be encouraging us to believe that it actually occurs. You can calculate that although the power of the different forces at the energies and distances we've presently measured seems to be different, so that they're not unified, when we make corrections for the spontaneous activity of the grid, the quantum fluctuations that distort our vision, we have to always see through them. We don't see down to the very shortest distances in the basics. If we make calculations to correct for those distortions, we find that the power of these different interactions actually does come together. And that's very exciting. But if you demand that it actually comes together, but to get it to come together really accurately, you have to up the ante and not only guess that the interactions are unified, but also add the concept of supersymmetry, which means expanding the equation to make them bigger and more beautiful and capable of transformations that take all the different kinds of particles one into the other. So really upping the ante to get complete unification. Then everything clicks together. And what's very exciting right now is that we're going to have the tool, namely the LHC, which will be capable of seeing whether those extra ingredients we need to make it all work really exist.
Okay.
Or in other words, whether those supersymmetric particles really exist.
Okay. And one last question. Some physicists are informally taking bets as to what we're going to find with the Large Hadron Collider. Mm-hmm. Some physicists say, well, of course, we'll get the Higgs boson. I talked to John Schwartz, a physicist at Caltech, and he was even saying that maybe we'll snag the first sparticle, super particle, a supersymmetric particle, as you mentioned, which could be a partner of one of the known subatomic particles. Other people say, I mean, there's no knowledge of how massive these sparticles could be, and so they're pessimistic. But do you have any thoughts about what you think we'll find with the Large Hadron Collider?
Yes. Well, I think we will definitely find out what this medium we're embedded in that slows things down and changes the motion of particles in a crude sense, gives them mass. We'll find out what that medium is made out of. I think and hope that it's not just one new particle. I think it will be more complicated and interesting than that. But so there will be not one Higgs particle, but several particles that contribute to the Higgs field and give it its structure. I would take long odds on that one. I'm very sure that that happened. I'm also heavily invested in supersymmetry. I've been, I did pioneering calculations that indicated that unification would work with supersymmetry, and I've been championing it consistently ever since. The issue you mentioned of whether the particles could be so heavy to escape detection of the LHC, I think, is at least partially addressed by the considerations like I mentioned to you. Namely, we need the effects of these supersymmetric particles as in their fluctuating form, as quantum fluctuations, to make the unification that appears so tantalizing really take place accurately. So that is a pretty good indication, I think, that supersymmetry would be realized at low energies, that is, low enough to be accessible to the LHC. So I wouldn't take 10-1 odds, but I would take maybe 8-1 odds on that one.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek, winner of the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics, professor at MIT, and author of a new book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces. Well, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. Good day.